The tragedy of Flight 302, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. When an Ethiopian Airlines plane crashed minutes after takeoff, all 157 people on board perished. Among them, a group of relief workers, remembered today by their colleague here in the U.S.
I couldn't believe I'm still in a state of shock. You know, like their family. To me, we're family, you know.
Also today, 60 years since an ill-fated uprising tried to end Chinese rule in Tibet. Plus, how this woman ended up joining the ranks of Acapulco's famous cliff divers.
And I thought to myself, one day, I'm going to be doing those high dives.
130 feet high. Those stories and much more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We begin today with the terrible news out of East Africa and the plane crash that killed 157 people on board. They were flying from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, to Nairobi, Kenya. The passengers were from 35 countries. And when you think about the different worlds of people on that plane represented and the humanitarian missions many of them dedicated their lives to, it's hard to know where to start. The aid group Catholic Relief Services lost four of its Ethiopian staff members in the tragedy. They were all colleagues and friends of Atli Bachu Mogas. We're so sorry for your loss. I'd like to just start with the names of your four colleagues from Ethiopia who died in this crash. Who are they?
Getenet Alamayo, Muluso Charanet, Sara Chalacho, Sintayo Aimika.
Four people, four Ethiopians working to build a better Ethiopia. I mean, they were all providing food aid in some way to their fellow Ethiopians. Can you share an anecdote or a story about just one of them and what they were doing?
Yeah, Sara used to work in the logistics department, and she was responsible to make sure, you know, all the commodities are recorded and reports are submitted on time. And Sara was separated from her mother while she was a child. And then she met her mother for the first time last year.
Wow.
You know, her mother left, and then she used to live in Germany, and she grew up with her father. So for the first time, she met her mother last year.
Mm. Why did Sara get into this work in the first place?
You know, in Ethiopia, there is a lot of, you know, drought and problems since it's a sub-Saharan country. And you know, always there is some kind of a problem. So, you know, she wanted to serve, you know, the people. And she wanted to be in this profession to help people.
Were they all headed to the same conference in Nairobi? What was the conference?
Yes, they were heading to a conference. I understand there was a training for cash distribution to the people whom we serve.
And as you say, with Sarah's case, I mean, she leaves behind a mother. All of them have families. What is it like for you, Atli, with four staff colleagues suddenly gone?
I couldn't believe I'm still in a state of shock. I worked with all of them for 3 years, and I know them very closely. And since we were working in emergency program, we spend most of our time in the offices, from Monday to Friday, and then sometimes Saturday and Sunday. And, you know, like their family, to me, we're family, you know. In CRS, you know, we work very closely together and spend a lot of time together. So, you know, we're like a family, not only co-workers.
I did see on the Catholic Relief Services website a statement really of determination saying the CRS family is shaken but not broken. I mean, how do you go on, though, at this point?
Yeah, you know, CRS, you know, we go through a lot of, you know, hard time. You know, CRS is like a family. So we support each other and, you know, we always, you know, work together and support each other to go through, you know, hard times. So that's what we're doing right now. In Ethiopia, also, the country representative went and visited, you know, all the families and is with them in the regional office as well as our headquarters. So we're getting all the support we need from our colleagues and from the leadership.
Atli Bachu Mogas with Catholic Relief Services in Addis Ababa, our deepest condolences to you and your office.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
The BBC's Larry Madowa spent a lot of the day at Jomo Kenyatta International Airport in Nairobi. That's where Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 was supposed to land yesterday. Madowa says relatives and friends of people on board have been gathering there for the past 24 hours.
Today, they've been getting more information from Kenyan authorities and from the Ethiopian Airlines management, who have told them if any of them want to fly to Addis Ababa to be closer with the investigation and the identification of their bodies, of their loved ones, that offer is available to them. At the same time, an emergency center has been set up in the Nairobi airport, where if any of them need any form of support, including counseling, that's offered to them for free.
And is Ethiopian Airlines flying at all today?
Not only is Ethiopian Airlines flying today, Marco, in fact, today there was another ET-302 that flew into Nairobi this morning, and we spoke to some of the passengers who were on that flight. They told us it was all as you might expect on any other flight. Nothing more unusual or eventful happened. They arrived here safely. As we speak right now, another Ethiopian Airlines flight is just about to land here at the Jomo Kenyatta International Airport. You must understand that this is a very popular route for Ethiopian Airlines. They fly into Nairobi four times a day. Mm. It's a quick shuttle, as you might expect, from actually the biggest airline on the continent.
What is the safety record of Ethiopian Airlines?
Ethiopian Airlines has what you might consider an excellent safety record on the continent. It is Africa's most successful airline. It flies the largest fleet, and it has had no major incident, at least not in comparison to the number of fatalities we've seen here, since 1996. That's when it had a hijacking. It did lose an aircraft in 2015 in Beirut, but nothing compares to the tragedy we've seen here, and especially on a continent where the air safety record can often be very problematic. Ethiopian Airlines has done exceptionally well, and they like to talk about how new and how modern their fleet is compared to others on the continent.
And what has the airline itself said about the crash in the last 24 hours?
The airline has taken the extraordinary step of grounding all of the Boeing 737 MAX 8s on its fleet. They said it's not because it had a defect, but out of an abundance of caution. And they are sending their best wishes to everybody who was involved, their thoughts and prayers. And they have said that the man who was in charge of this aircraft was a very experienced senior captain with 8,000 flight hours. This plane that crashed was only 4 months old. And in fact, it flew in from Johannesburg in South Africa into Addis Ababa the morning before it crashed on its way to Nairobi.
Even if the evidence ends up pointing to an issue with the 737 MAX 8, the Boeing aircraft in question, could this crash have an economic effect on the airline company, Ethiopian?
It is still too early to tell. This might have a much wider impact in people's confidence in the airline, but they've got to weigh the facts against all of the evidence, looking at other competitors for the company that might benefit, say, Kenya Airways or South African Airways. It's a small group of airlines, so it might see some minor effects on its bottom line, but I think long-term, the airline will survive.
Larry, I flew Ethiopian Airlines more than a dozen years ago. I know it's got great employee loyalty. Does it employ a lot of people in Ethiopia?
Ethiopian Airlines is seen as the pride of Ethiopia. The Prime Minister has said that, and even in declaring a day of national mourning today, he reiterated how much of an important part of the economy that Ethiopia is. It employs a lot of people. But when you think of what it has done, Ethiopian Airlines has made Addis Ababa the Dubai of Africa. Ethiopian Airlines is almost seen like the Emirates of Africa. It takes Africans from all around the continent, drops them in Addis, and then moves them on to Europe, to Asia, and to North America. And that's why it's been such a successful, tested business model.
The BBC's Africa business editor, Larry Madowa, speaking there from Jomo Kenyatta International Airport in Nairobi, the destination for Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 that crashed over the weekend, killing all 157 people on board. One of those passengers was a Nigerian man named Pius Adesami. He was a professor and the African Studies Director at Carleton University in Canada. Adesanmi regularly visited his native Nigeria, where he was an intellectual who loved and criticized his country. Here's Adesanmi in 2015 at a conference in Lagos, where he spoke about Nigerians' willingness to tolerate bad infrastructure. He had just arrived for the meeting and was stunned that the streetlights had gone out on the main road from the airport.
You'll see one streetlight with one bulb walking, and then darkness for another 10 kilometers between, you know, they didn't all die at once. It's one bulb at a time. So what is wrong? Again, fix it. Develop a culture of contempt for mediocrity.
A contempt for mediocrity. Nigerian scholar and writer Pius Adesanmi. Lola Shonei was a friend of his for many years. She's the director of the Ake Arts and Book Festival and joins us from Lagos, Nigeria.
I met him in the early 90s. We were both members of the Association of Nigerian Authors. We were the youngest in the group, and we were just there for each other to support each other. And we used to say to each other that we were going to work really hard to become international writers, and we'd wave to each other from different airplanes. We had a very close relationship, and he always referred to me as his Siamese twin because my birthday is on the 26th of February and his was on the 27th.
Yeah, so Siamese twins. I mean, you must have really bonded. What do you think was the connection?
I think it was the love of literature, but also the love that we both share for our homeland, our country, Nigeria. He was a very active participant in political discourse in Nigeria. He was very, very widely and broadly read, and he was prolific as well. But the thing about Pius's personality was also that he was pretty brilliant when it came to being supportive and encouraging others. So I remember he would always call me and say, what's going on? And I would tell him about the publishing house that I'd just created. And he would say, okay, so what are we going to do? What's the next step? He was just always there with great advice and great suggestions.
You mentioned his political discourse. What kind of reputation did he have in the Nigerian literary community?
You know, he was just fearless, you know. He never thought, okay, that's a big man. I can't write about him. He would take anybody on and any issue. And he was fearless and he was honest. And there was just no partisanship in the way that he approached issues. It was always about what's good governance and what's not good governance. And once he had even an inkling that any character was doing stuff that wasn't going to be helpful to the people, you know, he would take that person on. And he was also known for being, he was a humorist, so his pieces were generally quite funny. Even when the topic was serious, he was funny. But he was also a satirist, so he would, one of his books that he wrote, Naijano de Kari Last, I had the privilege of providing the blurb on the front cover. And I think it was just something like, Pius Adesanmi is the god of satire.
Did Pius Adesanmi connect with Africans beyond Nigeria?
He was constantly getting requests from different people to visit their African countries. So he had a way, because look, a lot of the problems are quite similar. This is the truth. I mean, he's addressing corruption in Nigeria. You just need to sometimes rub out the name of the country or just change it for another African country sometimes. So people could see how his work had a resonance. It did resonate with people from other African countries as well. But of course, because he was a professor in Canada at the University of Carleton, he also had this really broad network. One thing about Pius that I remember earlier on, I used to get a little bit protective of him. I would watch him talking to other people. And eventually I just thought to myself, you know what, this guy actually belongs to the whole world. He was just that kind of person who belonged to everybody. If you read through the tributes, you'll see that no one, not one person has a bad word to say about this guy. But apart from that, everybody thinks that they're Pius's best friend. And that's how he made people feel.
Lola Shonei speaking with us about her friend Pius Adesanmi. Pius was among the 157 people who died in the Ethiopian Airlines crash this weekend. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The political crisis in Venezuela has been simmering for years and boiled over 2 months ago. The latest sign of confusion and chaos is almost as bad as the lack of food and medicine. It's a nationwide power blackout, now into its fourth day. No electricity means many shops and businesses are closed. There are also reports that some patients have died at hospitals with no power. Today, the government of President Nicolas Maduro simply told workers to stay home. So who's to blame? Depends who you ask, says Will Grant. He's in the capital, Caracas, following the story for the BBC.
Well, in a sense, it's just an extension of everything else that's been going on to this point already. You know, if one supports President Maduro and believes his version of events, it is all part of the effort to overthrow him. He says the whole thing's being masterminded by Washington, and he believes that it was a cyber attack on the automated system that works in the hydroelectric dam that provides the domestic energy in Venezuela. The opposition, particularly the opposition leader Juan Guaido, say that's not true at all, that in fact what's happened is years of a lack of maintenance of those hydroelectric installations. Particularly, he pointed to what they say is the failure to cut back vegetation affecting power lines, and that caused a fire. Wherever one comes down on this argument sort of depends on one's politics, but certainly people are furious, and a lot of ordinary Venezuelans, poor Venezuelans who perhaps backed Mr. Maduro's predecessor, Hugo Chavez, are furious at his government for allowing this situation to arise. Schools have been suspended for several days now. A lot of workplaces haven't been up and running because simply the lights aren't on, the internet's not working, there's no electricity. You know, the blackout has caused such havoc across Venezuela. It's four straight days that many people have been without electricity. And obviously, tempers that were already frayed are boiling over. You know, it's getting very, very difficult. People are growing increasingly desperate now. We've seen attempts to loot stores. We've seen people go into supermarkets and come out with goods. We've seen running battles in some places with police, stone throwing. You know, it's getting ugly, no doubt about it.
The BBC's Will Grant reporting there from Caracas, Venezuela, where the power has been out for 4 days. We've got some striking images of what it's like for Venezuelans to live in darkness. Just head over to theworld.org. From life without electricity to life without the internet, tomorrow will be 30 years since the World Wide Web began. And since then, the ability to communicate, use maps, look up information, watch movies on demand, and so much more, it's all just exploded. If someone tried to restrict our internet access now, I'm guessing many of us would take to the streets. That's exactly what's been happening in Russia. Demonstrations in Moscow and elsewhere yesterday over the Russian government's plan to impose restrictions on the internet. I asked Moscow-based reporter Charles Maines what exactly is going on.
They have legislation that's working its way through the Duma, the parliament here, that would allow the federal authorities to take control over connection points, choke points, linking Russia to the global internet. And, you know, it's explained here as a defensive measure intended to defend Russia's digital sovereignty, as they like to say, amid any possible cyber attack against critical infrastructure.
Yeah, so basically we're talking like a Russia-wide web instead of a worldwide web, and the Kremlin would kind of filter everything?
That's right. It's sort of like a national kill switch to isolate Runet, the Russian internet, the Russian portion of the internet, from the global internet under some kind of attack. The problem is the critics say this is essentially like the Great Chinese Firewall, something that would separate Russia and obviously present some options for the authorities to crack down on opposition and alternative forms of thought in Russia.
So how are Russians responding to this idea of basically a Russia-wide web, this giant filter that the Kremlin would put on the internet?
Well, as you can imagine, it's kind of mixed. I think it depends a little bit on your age. You know, this demonstration yesterday was, of course, mostly overloaded with younger Russians. And there is a sense that essentially this law is being driven by people who grew up in the 70s, whereas the people defending Russia's internet freedoms are people in their 20s. So we have just an age gap here going on.
So we're about to hear from one of the lead organizers of the protests yesterday, a libertarian activist named Mikhail Svetov. How old is he?
Yeah, so Mikhail Svetov, he's 34. He's with the Libertarian Party in Russia. He was one of the co-organizers of yesterday's event, and he's pretty passionate about what he thinks.
Нельзя себя обманывать. Здесь все зависит от власти. Готова она к диалогу или не готова? Она неоднократно показывала.
And so what he's saying here is that the authorities, meaning the Kremlin, have just no avenues for dialogue with society. And what essentially that gives the option for people is just to take to the streets. He says, look, you know, they can arrest me, they can throw me in jail, or the opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, for example, but other people will come following me. Other people will come in my wake who are even angrier. And so this is, in a way, a tragedy for Russia.
Now, when it comes to Vladimir Putin, he's seen as a bit of a dinosaur when it comes to the web. Does he really not get it, or does he want us all to think that he doesn't get it? So how could Russia possibly be so sophisticated in cyber?
Right. You know, Putin is known as a guy who doesn't like the internet. He's openly called it a project of the CIA. He's very, very suspicious of it. And he became more suspicious of it back in 2011 when you had street protests throughout the Russian capital and other cities in Russia, which he felt was used, where the internet was used as the key kind of organizing platform. And so since then, you've seen the Kremlin launch a whole series of actions to try and sort of reclaim the cyberspace. These are repressive laws in terms of publishing. We just had a law, for example, last week, which essentially bans fake news, as according to the Russian authorities, and forbids insulting official institutions online. So essentially, that can be seen as, you know, total censorship, depending on how it's enforced. And so you have all these laws that are designed to kind of reclaim the cyberspace by the Russian authorities.
Can this particular set of restrictions on the web, this Russia-wide web, if you will, can they actually work, technically speaking? I mean, Russia tried to crack down on Telegram and failed at that.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the debates here we see in Moscow, certainly on Sunday, which is that some people, you know, there were 15,000 people showed up, maybe a bit more out on the streets there. Again, mostly younger Russians. But you have to think that younger Russians in masses would come out if they really felt that the internet was going to be locked off. And they can point to this effort to take down Telegram, this messaging app service that was launched by a young Russian named Pavel Durov. And the Russian authorities tried to shut that down and failed. And with this new law, there's also a lot of debate as how well they could actually enforce any efforts to isolate the Russian internet, to shut off these choke points, as they're called. Because, you know, fundamentally, you compare something like China, where they have maybe two, three main entry points for fiber cables. Well, and Russia has a fully developed internet environment. And so they're literally, you know, 90, hundreds of cables. So it's much harder to enforce this. But, you know, a lot of people like Svetov, who we heard from earlier, you know, he warns that it's a little bit careless to just expect that the Russian authorities will fail in their efforts.
Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow. Thanks, as always, Charles. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman. This week, Tibet marks 60 years since a rebellion tried and failed to overthrow Chinese rule. For some Tibetans, the fight continues.
If you think about the resources that the Chinese state has thrown at occupying Tibet and crushing Tibetan spirit, this issue should be over, and it's not. Far from it.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. People of Tibetan descent are keenly aware of an anniversary that's being marked this week, and for a lot of them, it's a bitter one.
I think for every Tibetan, ultimately, there's just a sort of a sadness and disbelief that it's six decades since March 1959.
That's Laden Tetong. Her father is from the generation of Tibetans that fled the capital Lhasa 60 years ago during the Tibetan uprising, March 1959. China had ruled Tibet for 8 years, and the rebellion was a failed attempt at Tibetan independence. Laden Tetong grew up in Canada hearing these stories. She's 42 and didn't experience the uprising, but her activism for Tibetan rights was shaped by those events 60 years ago.
It was the ultimate sort of breaking moment for their lives, for people fleeing into exile, for His Holiness leaving Tibet, the Dalai Lama leaving Tibet. All these years that Tibetans have had to either live in Tibet under Chinese occupation without the Dalai Lama, without their legitimate representation as they feel it. And then for all the Tibetans that have lived, like my father, in exile for so long, who thought for a very long time that they would be going home. 60 years is a long time.
The handful of reactionary elements, scorning the wishes and hopes of the people, launched a rebellion here on March 10, 1959. Our troops attack and occupy the rebel positions on Yuang Hill.
Tibetans often use these amazing pictures of Tibetans surrendering, and you see the Chinese coming up, you know, climbing up the mountain, holding guns in their hands, and it's actually Chinese government propaganda footage where they did reenactments.
The rebels, working hand in hand with foreign reactionaries, betrayed the motherland, and lacking the support of the people, they quickly crumbled. Many who were deceived or coerced into joining the ranks of the rebels are now surrendering their arms.
You know, I think one of the important things about 1959 March is this idea that actually, against incredible odds, Tibetans were saying no and standing up and saying enough of this. We, you know, after a decade of China trying to consolidate its rule in Tibet, China out, you know, Tibet for Tibetans. These are the slogans that they used. They were very clear. In the end, Tibetans just couldn't take it. Really, they handed us, for all of these years, they handed us a very clear legacy, which is that all the time the Chinese government has been trying to convince the world that Tibet belongs to them, that Tibet was always a part of China, that Tibetans are really just some Chinese minority. It's clear to us, our history is clear because of this incredible moment that Tibet belongs to Tibetans, that Tibetans did not want Chinese rule, that it was a foreign rule, it was an occupation. And that, I think, is so critical.
We're going to be back with more from the Tibetan Freedom Concert, but right now, here are the Beastie Boys on stage.
The Free Tibet movement is certainly in the West and outside of, you know, Tibet, say in the U.S. This is all, it has played a really important role. Because you don't see as many Free Tibet bumper stickers these days as you did back then, I mean, times have changed, but also the incredible surge in support for Tibet in the late 90s and early 2000s, that played a really critical role of helping Tibetans, I think, get through a very difficult time. There weren't the same sort of communications into Tibet at that time. People outside didn't necessarily really know what was happening inside. But Tibetans inside were aware of this global support. The Dalai Lama has the Nobel Peace Prize. People in Hollywood and people in positions of power in these foreign governments speak up for us. They knew that. And so it was, for all of us, an incredible morale boost, and that it helped us to solidify a kind of Tibet support that now, we didn't used to have very many Tibetans living in the West. So that movement gave rise to what we have now, which is Tibetan-led, active, grassroots movement. One of the greatest campaigns that Tibetans inside have waged, nonviolent campaigns against Chinese rule in recent years, came shortly after the 2008 uprising that swept across all of historical Tibet in the lead up to the Olympics in Beijing. They were using it on their social media profiles. They were using it sort of everywhere, and even making videos where they were saying, and it was very political, the statement, "I am Tibetan and I love Tibet." But it was creative in that it was harder for the Chinese government to crack down on them, because in a way what they were saying was not supposedly against the law or bad, or, but really they were making a very, very strong political statement to say these things. If you think about the resources that the Chinese state has thrown at occupying Tibet and crushing Tibetan spirit, this issue should be over, and it's not. Far from it. I think that the resistance spirit that was in the streets in Lhasa in March 1959 still exists, with an entirely new generation of Tibetans inside Tibet, where protests and resistance continues to this day.
Laden Tetong reflecting on the 60th anniversary of the Tibetan uprising, a failed attempt at overthrowing Chinese rule in Tibet. Laden lives here in Boston, where she's the director of the Tibet Action Institute. A different point of view from the Chinese, the Communist Party chief in Tibet, Beijing's representative there, recently said that Tibetans feel more affection for the Chinese government than they do for the Dalai Lama. He said the people of Tibet are, quote, extremely grateful for the prosperity that the Communist Party has brought them, end quote. That is the official government line, of course. We're also interested in the U.S. government's perspective. For that, here's Sarah Sewell. She spoke with my colleague, Carol Hills.
Sarah, you were the special coordinator for Tibetan issues at the U.S. State Department under President Obama. What exactly is the U.S. government's policy toward Tibet?
Well, we've had a long-standing policy in the United States, and it was interesting listening to Loudon's history. You know, the Free Tibet movement in many ways was an inspiration for passing a law in Congress that created the position that I occupied. It encapsulated the bipartisan view that the United States should continue to support the Tibetan people because it was an issue of freedom of religion, because it was an issue of human rights and cultural autonomy, but also because it was an issue of supporting democracy. And the U.S. official position has been that the Dalai Lama is the legitimate spokesperson for the Tibetan person and that he and his representatives should be in a dialogue with the Chinese government to guarantee the independence of Tibetan cultural practices. But this is an issue that puts the U.S. directly in competition with the official Chinese position. And so it's one that many administrations have tiptoed around, and this administration in particular, I think, has an opportunity in the context of a more assertive China policy to reestablish that commitment to Tibetan rights.
Technically, the U.S. recognizes China, and China says Tibet is part of China. So how do you parse that?
Well, you parse it in the way that we've managed rights issues in a lot of instances, which is to say you can have territorial sovereignty over an area, but that doesn't mean that you can extinguish the rights of the people that live within it.
When you were special coordinator for Tibetan issues, what did you hear from China? Was there ever any kind of acceptance of the U.S. view?
The Chinese have a one-way communications policy on Tibet, and it has to do with simply describing His Holiness the Dalai Lama as a devil incarnate and as a terrorist. The Chinese, in other words, have a propaganda point of view that is not, in my estimation, represented by facts on the ground, but they brook no discussion about dialogue with His Holiness.
So how were you able to do your job as special coordinator for Tibetan affairs at the State Department if the Chinese won't even talk about it?
Well, one of the ways you do your job is to continually raise the issue so that they are forced to acknowledge the fact that it's still a central element of American foreign policy. There were other elements that we could do as well. One was the continuation of a relationship with His Holiness the Dalai Lama and the elected government in exile. We, the U.S. government, provide financial support for everything from health to education for Tibetans in exile. And then the third piece is to continue to represent that symbolic support internationally, which is really important. Increasingly, we see that countries that have typically spoken out on behalf of Tibet are now shying away from doing so. Heads of state, leaders of parliament are more reluctant to meet with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. This means that the symbolic act of visibly, for example, having the president or the secretary of state welcome His Holiness the Dalai Lama into official meeting rooms is really important diplomatic symbolism that's absent right now.
What do you see as the Trump administration approach to Tibet compared to the Obama administration?
Well, there's been a 2-year absence of any activity on the part of a special coordinator because the position's been empty and there was silence, to the best of our knowledge, in terms of official interactions with the Chinese on Tibetan issues.
But what about now? I mean, in December, President Trump signed a law that will punish Chinese officials who prevent Americans from traveling freely to Tibet. What's the significance of that law?
Well, the significance of that law is that the Congress, in its bipartisan support for reciprocal treatment, has essentially provided that legislation to the Trump administration. Many people had been working for some time on reciprocity because people can't travel to the Tibetan Autonomous Region, whereas the Chinese have enormous freedom within the United States. So the law's a good thing. It's just that it comes from Congress, not from the executive branch. And there are many things that the Congress cannot do. The Congress cannot make the President of the United States meet with His Holiness the Dalai Lama.
How much can the U.S. afford to make Tibet a priority when the relationship with China is so complex and so consequential in terms of trade, security, climate change, and other issues?
This is the perennial question about what is the place of values versus interests in American foreign policy, and it's not unique to Tibet. Whenever we're asked to think about what are the values that we represent as a nation, whether they're human rights or whether they're democratic ideals, we face trade-offs in terms of how much we can push. But there's a huge difference between remaining silent and stating positions. At this point, we don't even have the moral leadership of pointing out the importance of this issue. We aren't engaging the Chinese in a public way on these issues.
That's Sarah Sewell. She was the special coordinator for Tibetan issues at the U.S. State Department under President Obama. She was speaking with my colleague, Carol Hills. You will remember the case of Kim Jong-nam, the half-brother of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Kim Jong-nam was assassinated at the airport in Kuala Lumpur in 2017. Two women were charged in his murder, and the trial is underway in Malaysia. Their lawyers have argued that the women were duped into taking part in the killing. And today, a surprise development in the case. We asked the world's Patrick Nguyen to bring us up to date.
This was a very strange, well-plotted assassination. It's believed that North Korean agents found these women and hired them to participate in what they said was a prank show, a TV prank show, having them rub substances on strangers' faces in public places. The target of this was Kim Jong-nam, the brother of Kim Jong-un. One woman rubbed a substance on his face and sort of ran off saying, "Sorry, sorry." Not too long after that, another woman comes up and sort of hugs him and rubs a second substance on his face. Well, VX nerve agent is the way that you usually deliver that to a target is you rub one half of the chemical combination on someone and then the other half, and then it seizes up their muscles and they very quickly die. That appears to be what happened to Kim Jong-nam. He ran to the bathroom, he tried to wash this stuff off, and he began to die very quickly right there in the airport.
We start in Malaysia, where new details have emerged surrounding the murder of Kim Jong-nam, the half-brother of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un.
Today was supposed to be the resumption of a hearing against one of the women, an Indonesian woman named Siti Aisyah. She's in her late 20s. What happened, though, was the judge canceled the case and said that she was free to go. In fact, she's already back home in Indonesia. She said, "This is my day of freedom." She was extremely tearful, and she said she wasn't expecting this to happen herself. She wasn't expecting that she would be allowed to go home so quickly. So it was a shock to her as well. There were two women charged in this crime. Don Ti-hung from Vietnam, her fate is not yet resolved. She has not yet been released. In fact, she faces more hearings later this week, and we're not exactly sure what's going to happen with her. So as for why Kim Jong-nam was targeted in the first place, he was on the outs with his family, with the Kim dynasty. He was groomed to be dictator material, but he turned out not to be dictator material. He kind of sloughed off and ended up living a sort of quiet life in the city of Macau, sort of a gambling mecca. After his brother's ascent to the throne, it could be that Kim Jong-un and the Kim regime saw him as a loose end that needed to be taken out. He certainly knew a lot and was capable of embarrassing them or humiliating them with all the stuff he knew.
The World's Patrick Nguyen reporting from Bangkok with the latest in the strange case of the murder of Kim Jong-un's half-brother, Kim Jong-nam. The cliff divers of Acapulco, Mexico. You know these guys. They're famous all over the globe for one thing, leaping off a platform carved out of the cliffs and plunging into the waters of the Pacific Ocean, more than 130 feet below. I say guys because there are hardly any women who do this. So Paula Medina was a rarity when she joined their ranks. But the path Paula took to get to those cliffs above Acapulco is even more unusual. The BBC's Clayton Kahn has that story.
Far from the thumping reggaeton, towering modern hotels, and sweaty crowded beaches of Acapulco Bay, I find myself on a quiet cliff with a majestic view of the vast Pacific Ocean. I'm here to meet one of the city's famed cliff divers, whose beginnings in the iconic sport are anything but conventional.
I'm a journalist by trade, and one day I discovered the sport of lucha libre wrestling. I had to cover a story and interview these female Japanese wrestlers. The coach invited me to train with him, and well, I said, why not?
The phrase, why not, seems to be a defining principle in Paula's life. Her short stature and complete lack of experience in professional wrestling didn't concern her. She was, in fact, quite eager to learn how to throw around masked men dressed in brightly colored spandex three times her size.
I began to train in wrestling, and it was very difficult because I was training with the professional male wrestlers, and well, they treated me just like the other men. I thought to myself, if I am able to do this, I can do anything.
And although Paula's mind said she could do anything, her body was perhaps second-guessing that. Doing the weekly moves like pile drivers, backbreakers, and of course the aerial driving headbutts took a toll on her small frame. So the doctors prescribed her with swimming classes to get her body back into working order, a seemingly inoffensive exercise routine. But of course, Paula didn't want to make it so easy.
I would go to a pool to swim. That is where I saw kids diving from 10 meters high. And to me, they seemed so brave. And I thought to myself, one day, I'm going to be doing those high dives.
Alain Carreño, a professional ex-Olympic high diver who is known for putting on daredevil shows by lighting himself on fire as he graciously somersaults into pools, was the coach of those children.
I began to practice by myself.
She didn't climb up to the diving board. Rather, she would jump from the side of the pool into the pool. That is where I first saw her.
I was doing backflips that I learned in Lucha Libre wrestling.
She kept doing it again and again, and so I went up to her.
And told me that.
If you want, I can teach you how to dive the right way.
I said, well, okay, sure. I trust your judgment.
We would be laughing half the time because this isn't Lucha Libre wrestling. I would constantly remind her, here you don't have to fling yourself into the water. No one is waiting for you, just the water. And the water is not going to fight back. In high diving, you move your body with beauty.
A good mix of why not and yes, I can prompted Paula to dive into the invitation to participate in a weekend marathon. She traded the pool's chlorine water for the salty waves of the ocean.
I came to Acapulco to participate in a swimming marathon in the ocean. It was a moment that changed my life. I remember it vividly, soaking in the entire experience and just thinking to myself that I am in the middle of the sea. There's nothing else. If someone were to take an aerial photo of me, I'd be this tiny little speck. After that, all I could think of was Acapulco, Acapulco. My heart said that something is going to happen in Acapulco. So I quit my job, left my house, moved to Acapulco, and said to myself, I won't lose anything by trying it.
When she arrived, she got in touch with a local diving instructor.
I called him up and he told me to meet him at the Quebrada. I went and he told me that he could train me there. I said, wait, what?
La Quebrada. It is the most iconic point in Acapulco. It is a 40-meter high cliff that was dynamited out of the towering and jagged granite rocks that tumble into the Pacific Ocean. Since the 1930s, it has been famous for its cliff divers that make a living putting on daily shows by taking the death-defying head-first plunge into the shallow Pacific waves below. So, of course, Paola was surprised that this would be her new diving board.
Well, you need to climb the cliff just in your bathing suit, barefoot, without gloves or harness. You know that if you slip, you'll fall, and that's it. When I first started training, my feet and knees would be all cut up from the rocks, and there are some parts where you only cling on with the tips of your fingers and toes. It is in those moments when you are saying aloud many curse words, which is my way of alleviating stress. When you start out, you sometimes fall into the water wrong. You hurt a shoulder, your head, or your neck.
It is said that hitting the water from higher than 3 meters is like falling onto concrete. If you don't know how to coordinate your body properly, or if you hit the water on your back or stomach, it can even burst your internal organs.
Yet, when you're finally up there, about to take the plunge, you only think of the moment. There are no distractions, nothing.
Paula kept returning to the cliff, earning the respect of the locals, and as one of the few women doing it, fame. Just blocks from the Quebrada, a three-story mural of the grinning diver in her bathing suit is plastered on the side of a hotel. Yet for the journalist turned wrestler turned high diver, the real rewards of her perseverance are much more humble.
Well, when something gets stuck in your head and doesn't go away, you need to do it. Before I came to Acapulco, I would think to myself, what happens if I don't go? All my life, I'll be stuck with the curiosity of what would have happened if I went. I took a risk. I left my job, my family, I left everything and came here alone. But it was worth it. It is kind of the same thing when you're about to take the plunge. You're up there thinking aloud, do I jump or not? Do I jump or not? In the end, you jump, and you're left with this immense feeling of satisfaction.
Definitely not your average career path. Wow. Acapulco cliff diver Paula Medina. She was speaking with the BBC's Clayton Kahn. We're also jumping off because it is the end of the hour. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Back with you all tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.